My name is John Beck, and with my co-director, Kurt Dewhurst, we run here at the MSU Museum and on campus our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, which is really dedicated to looking at the intersection of culture and work broadly defined. And it's been a great partnership. We have to announce that we have an upcoming exhibit in the foyer. That's the extent of my French, by the way, Jeanine. Foyer.
Well done. Well done.
The foyer, for those of us who don't know how to pronounce it. But the foyer, we're using that area, which we've used for a number of exhibits. There's a current one in it. But we're showing a lot of the different art, folk art, and other things that we have from our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives collection here at the MSU Museum. Some of those pieces have never been seen before in public, so we would love you to come to that exhibit. That's going to be in the months of April and May. And we have a variety of other things coming up with our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives connection. Currently, we have an exhibit that we are co-sponsoring at the MSU Law School, which is some of the work of Detroit artist Nora Chapa Mendoza, who has spent much of her life chronicling the lives of other Latina and Latino immigrant workers through her paintings. And it's a very interesting show because it has some of her political paintings as well as landscapes, abstracts, and other things. That's currently going on through the beginning of March over at the law school, so we invite you over there. We also have an exhibit that will be opening, in fact, two exhibits with our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives sponsorship here at the museum in the fall. So there's a kind of a very heady mix of things, and we'll talk more about that one down the line. But obligatorily, if I did not hand out flyers, it would not be a brown bag. So we actually have three brown bags coming up in the month of February. Amy Bromson, who's also from Wayne State, who teaches as an adjunct within their political science department, has done work on women in the UAW. So her talk, which is coming up on February 1st, is they all sort of disappeared, the early cohort of UAW women leaders. So I'll just hand that one back. Coming up a week after that, Shoma Chaudhary from the Department of Sociology here is going to be talking about organizing in a precarious world of work, the Self-Employed Women's Association of India. Very interesting work, so come back for that. And last but not least, John Basler, whose wife Jennifer Stinson, both are in the history department at Saginaw Valley State University. She did a presentation you might remember last year on Native Americans and other things here in Michigan in relation to labor. John's coming in to talk about disciplining the inaccurate instrument of intimidation, organized labor's campaign against the polygraph, 1965 to 1988. Fascinating look at the intersection of policing, issues of national security, and organized labor. And last but not least, the rest of the Brown Bag series, we have a wonderful lineup throughout the semester. And our semester starts today. Our semester starts with the wonderful scholar and organizer, Jeanine Lanza. I've known Jeanine for a number of years in connection to the North American Labor History Conference at Wayne State University that she has been the pilot of for a number of years. She handed that over to her colleague, Fran Shore, who's been responsible for the last couple of years. And Jeanine did just a first-rate job making continuing the tradition and making great strides with the Labor History Conference at Wayne. It makes Wayne State the epicenter of all labor history, kind of a serious scholarship in terms of the people that come to Wayne State to be part of that conference. The other thing that's really important to understand about that conference is many people come because the Reuther Archives, of course, is one of the premier places to study organized labor, especially 20th century and 21st century organized labor. So in that way, it's a very wonderful mix of resource and conversation and everything else, and I would commend that to you. So please do sign in. Now, today's talk by Janine is co-sponsored by the MSU Center for European and Russian-Eurasian Studies. So thanks to Norm and the folks at the center for circulating information about the talk. Janine was educated both at the University of Chicago and also at Cornell University, where she received her PhD. Her work is on early modern Europe, and much of it is not only labor history, but women's history as well. Her book on Ashgate Press was on wives and widows in early modern Paris. And I always marvel, since I have a hard enough time with English, for any of those scholars who not only speak multiple languages, but do research in multiple languages, and Janine is one of those. She's a friend, she's a colleague, and I think it's a wonderful that we have Janine Lanza with us today to talk from her current research project, Laughing the Master Down, Artisan Culture and the Meaning of Emotions in 18th Century Paris. So please join me in welcoming Janine Lanza.
Thank you for that extremely kind introduction. It's very, very nice. And it's nice to hear you tout the Labor History Conference, because we're always trying to get the word out. What a great activity that is. As John said, this is a work that I'm just getting started on. And so this is the first time anyone is hearing it other than myself. So I'm really looking forward to getting your feedback. I'm going to read my paper. And I hope I've left enough time for questions at the end. On the 21st of May, 1750, Nicolas Maillot, a commissioner from Châtelet, the site of the pre-revolutionary Parisian police, was called to investigate a matter for the Pastry Makers Guild. This investigation was requested by five guild jurés, or guild officers, and involved an incident that occurred during one of the most important ceremonies, the assessment of masterpieces by those aspiring to become masters in the guild. The ceremony was disrupted when Étienne Thomas and Charles Vaflard, members of the guild, entered the house where the masterpiece was being examined and tasted and began to insult the jury. After arriving, Vaflard and Thomas immediately began to insult and curse at the other attendees. Finally, increasingly out of control, according to witnesses, they jostled one of the oldest masters, quote, such that several drops of sauce from a pastry fell on a paper being used to record the proceedings. The two men were also heard laughing by several witnesses, quote, mocking the other masters, as one of the witnesses put it, an act which seemed to particularly insult the guild officers and other participants. Based on an initial complaint, the Commissioner Maillot later brought in more than two dozen witnesses in order to write up an inquiry about this incident. Now, just to give you some perspective, this is about 30 pages of an investigation. 24 witnesses is enormous. Most of the cases that I found in this Châtelet record, two paragraphs, a few people talking about some kind of conflict. So this is a big deal. We are in France. So we're in fact, not only we're in France, we're in Paris. So in the best century ever, the 18th century. Such disputes, like the one I just introduced you to, were a regular feature of artisanal life in 18th century France. The Chambre de Police, the section of the police that dealt with guild matters, heard numerous such complaints from masters, workers, and customers. The parties often engaged in shouting matches, traded insults and curses, and at times even resorted to fisticuffs. The commissioner would come to the scene and record each side's account before leaving. The parties in these quarrels seem to have taken the cases no further than lodging a complaint, although the weight of these disputes created a thread of conflict within guild culture. In addition to individual complaints, guilds as corporate bodies brought legal cases before the Chambre de Police, not only to assert their interests, material and otherwise, but also to shape and define the broad terrain of the guilds. Legal complaints allowed guilds to monopolize certain materials and techniques as exclusive to their enterprises, and thus delegitimize outsiders from engaging in the kinds of work claimed by guilds. They defined workers' status as honorable or dishonorable, a designation that had salience beyond the confines of the guilds. Such cases also served to define guild values and culture, laying out what behavior was acceptable and laudatory and what merited censure. Examining the culture of conflict negates the notion that guild structure was unified and consensual. In contrast to the image of a unified corporate body that guild officers sought to advance, conflicts between masters, workers, and clients reveal a discordant and disorderly institution. Seen from this perspective, guild culture was much more complicated than the idealized notions of harmonious and hierarchical work organizations that those institutions tried to project. Rather, much of the culture of guilds was defined by the legalistic conflict over privileges and identity, a fact reflected in the prominent part legal activity played for the corporations as well as their individual members. Given this legal dimension of artisanal life, it is not surprising to find that the conflict between Guild Juré and Thomas and Vaflard reveal aspects of artisanal culture. Let me just say, I cut a lot of this out for the talk, and so I'm only going to talk about this one case, but I do have other examples that follow this model. You'll just have to trust me on that. They provide a window into how guild members and workers interacted, how they governed themselves, and what issues they clashed over. Furthermore, the language of these cases reveals how guild members conceived of their roles and how they defined themselves relative to one another. As institutions, guilds existed for a number of reasons. They organized skilled productions in early modern French cities. They provided economic privileges to their members, thus creating an economic monopoly and restricting competition. They controlled the supply and movement of workers, helping to assert control over potentially unruly workers. They set wages, they provided a sense of honor and distinction to their members, and granted status and identity to them as well. Guilds also provided social support to their members in various forms. All of these elements contributed to the ways guilds and their members functioned internally and in society at large. Part of this process was creating a sense of a shared culture that provided a framework for performing all of these functions. Artisanal culture, the way artisans did things, how they understood their society and their places in it, their values and goals, attempted to bind together the sometimes contradictory economic and social functions of the guilds. In addition to looking at these formal rules and practices, we can also uncover artisan culture by examining evidence of practice like police complaints. The coarse and obscene language, emotional attacks, brazen insults, and occasional violence recorded there seem more suited to a street brawl than an interaction between skilled professionals who belonged to the same organization and were devoted to serving shared economic and cultural interests. These cases give us a glimpse at the words and actions of artisans, but their meaning is not apparent. The heightened emotional and combative nature of these court cases, jarring to the modern ear, provides a way to understand artisan culture that illuminates the social and economic dimensions, but that also helps to reveal the emotional substance of this culture. Following William Reddy's framework on the meaning of emotion, I will examine this court case to show that along with disputes over privileges and economic access, artisans in the 18th century were also engaged in conflict over the emotional meaning of guild life and how that affected their own culture and identity. Emotions can be another tool for grasping culture since, and here I quote Reddy, a community's emotional order must take the form of ideals to strive toward and strategies to guide individual effort. Exploring emotional language reveals a level of individual engagement with culture that goes beyond an analysis of guild statutes, publications, or even police complaints. Such language reveals the economic and social dimensions of guilds, but also goes further to get at individual perception of the culture and practices. Disputes and legal complaints served as one way to express a vision of identity as both part of and in opposition to artisanal communities. Complaints reveal workers who take offense easily, anger quickly, defend their honor fervently, and delight in flinging insults at their rivals. Historians of the guilds have suggested that artisans argued over honor, over positions in the guild, over pay and work condition, and over different understandings of the meanings and purposes of guilds. While all of those issues do come up in these disputes, I would suggest that we pay attention to the language of emotion that frame these clashes in order to understand more fully the individual basis and meaning of artisan culture. The insults, anger, and outrage expressed by the parties all reveal a deeply emotional and personal understanding of what it meant to be a member of a guild. Dissatisfaction or disagreement was not expressed in calm, reasoned language, but in epithets and curses. And those insults were personal, aimed at individuals' characters rather than the work they performed.
I would argue that by analyzing and contextualizing the emotions expressed in this Thomas Vaflau complaint, we can understand artisan culture in a deeper way, one that examines the ideas of honor and hierarchy, two important organizing principles of guild life in terms of individual expressions and understandings. Although the notion of honor was often used to characterize guilds and their members with respect to outsiders, outsiders often being seen as dishonorable, analyzing the emotional language of guild disputes will show how guild members themselves experienced and fought over the notion of honor that they used internally to structure themselves. It will also demonstrate how, quote, the past actors whose motivations we are so eager to understand must themselves be seen as products of evolving emotional norms, end quote. Particularly in the contrast between the responses of guild officers and those of the provoking workers, we see some of the divergence between the elites of the guilds, those who defined and enforced status within the institution and most benefited from it, and those who worked under that regime and did not have the ability to shape the norms of their groups and who were excluded from full membership and belonging. Now, in assessing artisanal culture and identity, we must not lose sight of the broader economy to which that production belonged. Increasingly, artisanal production was characterized by instability and change. The 18th century economy in France, as in the rest of Europe, was marked by a rapid acceleration of consumption and production of consumer goods. In this period, quote, a growing number of households acted to reallocate their productive resources in ways that increased both the supply of market-oriented money-earning activities and the demand for goods offered in the marketplace. The response by master artisans to this increasing demand was one based on the idea of constant returns to scale, that is, the expansion of production by subcontracting and putting out, rather than by centralizing and rationalizing assembly of goods. What this meant was that masters added and subtracted workers, either journeymen or temporary laborers, as orders came and went. For artisans, this response to fluctuating demand brought about insecurity, since labor could be added to or reduced by the employer without difficulty to expand or contract the volume of output in response to demand. The guilds did nothing to stop this practice. This kind of uncertain labor and production market created anxiety among masters, but more markedly among journeymen. No longer anchored to the idea that apprenticeship led to journeymanship, led to mastership, artisanal workers became more insecure and less attached to official ideas and definitions of guild membership. In this climate where guild membership was becoming increasingly elusive for many journeymen and apprentices, marginalized workers found it difficult at times to support the values espoused by the guilds. Added to the increasing economic turmoil resulting from greater market volatility is the problem that even available masterships increasingly benefited sons and sons-in-law of masters. Artisanal families used their membership in the guild to benefit themselves, and in the process, shut down the promise of guild membership for those who went through the socialization process offered by the guilds. Apprentices and journeymen increasingly saw a future where they would be permanent employees of masters without the possibility of moving into mastership themselves. This development within the guilds, coupled with the destabilizing shifts in the broader economy, created a sense of detachment from the traditional promise of the guilds, one that I see manifesting itself in artisan disputes. These transformations in the economy did not mesh especially well with official guild structures. The guild model envisioned a process wherein workers moved from apprenticeship to journeymanship to mastership in a span of time suited to the requirements of the trade. For drapers, the journey could take as few as 3 years. For watchmakers, it was 7 years, and so on. Aspirants could count on eventually being admitted as full members. As masters, they could marry and establish a family, set up and run a business, and generally take on the status of an independent and honorable man in society. The reality of guild life in the 18th century and perhaps always did not correspond to this ideal. Guilds offered fewer opportunities to advance from rank to rank, a narrowing of opportunity that meshed with the more insecure footing workers experienced in a job market that chased consumer demand through hiring and firing at need, a situation at odds with official guild ideology. Now, despite the language of inclusion and membership, on the most basic level, guilds were, of course, institutions of economic organization. They served as one way to sort workers into distinct groups and grant privileges and status to some while withholding those benefits from others. While purporting to label workers according to the labor they performed, guilds simultaneously created an identity, quote, through erecting and maintaining boundaries between an imagined us and an imagined them. This creation of boundaries dovetailed with the larger hierarchical character of early modern European society, where identity was relational and thus rooted in a subjective experience of difference. People knew who they were and how they fit into their society in relation to others. Members of a guild, in addition to enjoying the right to engage in a particular segment of the economy, belonged to a group that could claim certain privileges and that lifted up members above outsiders. While all work at this time was seen as debasing to some extent, unskilled workers, called gens sans état, were the most reviled of all. Workers affiliated with the guilds, whether as apprentices, journeymen, or masters, all took pride in their état, in the fact that they had a position in the social hierarchy that lifted them above those who merely labored as they could for their daily bread. In order to support their efforts to confer status, economic, social, and moral, the guilds had to construct a justification for their privileges, one that offered benefits to society rather than simply the guilds themselves. They took a number of approaches to making this argument. In line with their economic roles, guild leaders argued that limiting economic production to guild members ensured the public that products they purchased were of high quality in terms of raw material and labor used in production. Even opponents of the guild system, in considering how to guarantee the quality of products introduced into the marketplace, acknowledged that it depended on the official word of artisans. They also saw themselves as gatekeepers against the invasion of large-scale fraud in the marketplace in the form of spoiled and harmful goods being proffered to customers under false pretenses. In addition to instilling confidence in the buying public, guilds also sought to instill confidence that they used their associations to control potentially disruptive and subversive workers. Without such structures, guild officers argued, chaos and disorder would endanger not only the economic order, but also the social order. Unconstrained, undefined workers could work and act freely, thus upsetting not only the structure of the marketplace, but of society writ large. One of the ways guilds prevented such mayhem, was to promote their system of organization and classification as tools of social and political control. By this argument, guilds undertook to control workers by confining them in their institutions, using the possibility of attaining a mastership or the threat of loss of affiliation with the guild as a mechanism for enforcing compliance with corporate statutes. The importance of defending the honor of the guilds and their members also became a justification for the protected status that guilds sought for themselves. According to guild leaders, skilled work could not be deregulated without resulting in the degradation of the workplace and society as a whole. In fact, the definition of skill, quote, was as much a cultural construct articulating boundaries of a community defined by status and a sense of difference as an indicator of the economic capacity of a worker. For guilds, economic, social, moral, and cultural factors meshed, and illegal, from the point of view of the guild, an illegal worker could not produce a correct product, not only because he lacked the training and technique, but also because his work and he as an individual were not tempered and restrained by the hierarchical and moral framework of the corporate body. As much as anything else, artisans define themselves and their work by their embeddedness in accepted and approved social structures. Their sense of honor and their sense of distinctiveness made them artisans, a collective identity buttressed by the oath masters took when they achieved mastership. That oath marked the moment when he quote, entered a trade and therefore acquired a particular état. An artisan's membership in his état permanently fixed his place in the social order and defined his rights, dignities, and obligations. Part of sharing this état meant accepting the idea that the interests and opinions of underlings needed to be subordinated to the needs and rules of the group. Guild masters had no interest in listening to or accommodating their unruly journeymen or apprentices. They demanded obedience and produced it on both individual and social levels. This aim and the subservience it required and produced had the potential to create tension and animosity within the ranks of the guilds. Records of disputes within the guilds manifest these tensions connected to the tight control over resources, material, emotional material and authority, which is reflected in statutes and other expressions of guild identity. Artisanal culture sought to mediate these tensions and oppositions with varying degrees of success. Now, the earliest statutes of the guilds, as well as police complaints from the beginning of the 18th century onward, all used a language of honor to describe the culture of guilds, and the notion of honor sought to bring together potentially fractured factions. The stinging reception of insults, the need not only to respond in kind, but to bring a complaint against the offending party, suggests that even in daily interactions, guild members were constantly vigilant about defending their honor. When Thomas and Vaflard laughed at the masters assembled to judge a masterwork, they were not simply being rude and insulting. They were also undermining the decorum and hierarchy of the guild itself. The meaning of guilds, how they functioned and defined themselves, depended in important ways on a, quote, combination of precedent and appeals to natural rights, which meant that a working life in the 18th century French trades was full of words. The words defined legal status, the relationship of the guild to public authority and internal relations. The police complaints that reveal so much about how guilds navigated business disputes and personal disagreements also demonstrate the importance of emotional words for shaping the meaning of the guild to its members, especially in instances where the parties had different statuses, where masters fought with journeymen or guild officers fought with masters. Emotional and especially obscene language could undermine those differences. When journeymen or ordinary masters characterized their superiors in insulting and profane terms, they, like Robert Darton's famous cat-killing printers, pushed against these status distinctions, questioning the privileged standing of those above them. In real terms, journeymen, apprentices, workers, and even customers had few ways to push back against the authority and arrogance of guildmasters and jurés. There were no institutional paths for complaining or asking for change. Unhappy workers could only put up with their masters and perhaps hope to change their employment situation at some point, although masters tightly controlled even changing jobs by holding on to certificates to keep workers in their employ. One available outlet for frustrations in this very narrow environment was cursing and violent outbursts. Even a worker with little hope of changing masters could throw something, verbally abuse his employer, or mock him. Robert Darton pointed out this impulse in his analysis of the Great Cat Massacre. The account of that event noted that after being discovered by the master and mistress, that the printers in their shop found the mistress's favorite cat, put it on trial, and then killed it, and hid it from the master and mistress, and then they find out, and there's a big to-do. Anyway, quote, the printers delighted in the disorder. They were beside themselves with joy. What a splendid subject for their laughter. In the absence of other tools to act out against a master, a range of emotional responses served this purpose. Formal guild culture emphasized harmony and obedience, with the assumption that all members of the guild would respect and be bound by these shared values. In the face of these domineering standards, artisans used their emotional expressions to challenge and evade them. Now, emotional expression and the rules that help to understand and interpret emotions are particular to different times and places, products of, quote, varying structural factors that shape emotional life. William Reddy uses the term emotives to define not only emotional acts and reactions, but also the cultural reasons for them and responses to those emotional acts. He explains that emotives are a type of speech act, quote, which both describe and change the world, because emotional expression has an exploratory and a self-altering effect. Furthermore, Reddy carefully lays out the ways that emotional speech and actions are rooted in the time and place where they exist. Excuse me. He looks at the work of anthropologists in particular to show how emotions and the ways people understand and express them are particular to a specific context. In the same way, emotional expressions and receptions differ across time. The ways people in the past communicated anger, love, envy, or happiness differs considerably from contemporary practices. Unearthing the meanings of emotional expressions in the past can reveal multiple aspects of that culture, as well as its points of tension and discord. Now, the emotional culture of France was shifting during the 18th century, moving from an age of restraint expressed by the codes of etiquette enforced at the royal court and in elite society, to one that placed greater value on a developing conception of sentiment, that is, on a greater openness and naturalism in personal relationships and the expression of feelings. The emotional culture of Louis XIV's court at Versailles was noted for its closed and formal qualities. Under the guise of civility, the king ruled over actions, demanding that nobles accede to his wishes in the realm of careers, marriages, and offices, while playing down or ignoring the emotional repercussions of those commands. Just to give one example, Louis XIV ordered his nephew, the Duc de Chartres, to marry one of the king's illegitimate daughters. The young man and his family were sorely disappointed. They had hoped to arrange a much more advantageous match. The Duc de Chartres and his mother sobbed and raged, but with no hope of changing the king's mind. The evening of this blow, the aggrieved man and his mother were required to dine with the king, and although they displayed cold and quasi-rude behavior, the king ignored it, knowing that his decree would be obeyed. The rules of etiquette and civility that prevailed at court demanded that actions, rather than emotions, conform to its dictates. The king was not interested in the Duc de Chartres' state of mind. He commanded actions rather than feelings. This attitude toward emotions shifted in the following century, part of a series of major cultural, economic, and social changes that took place in the 18th century. With the center of society moving away from the royal court and toward the drawing rooms, literary salons, and commercial spaces of Paris, the stiff and inauthentic manners of Versailles were pushed aside in favor of a more natural and open expression of feelings. By the end of the century, quote, sincerity of emotion had become a mark of virtue and truth alike. This phenomenon came to be called sentimentalism, which emphasized emotions as a force for good in human affairs, and enthusiasm for emotional expression and intimacy, for emotional refuge from a prevailing code of honor. Salons and Masonic lodges, in particular, became places where the rigid code of honor and etiquette, the constant awareness of social difference and social expectations, could be put aside in favor of free conversation and expression. Such spaces also began to open up the extreme authority certain members of society could theoretically exercise over others, such as in families where fathers dominated their wives and children, or in guilds where apprentices and journeymen were treated as minors subject to the paternal authority of their masters. It was in this space that journeymen pushed back against their masters in both emotional and concrete terms. Numerous conflicts, such as the one I've been talking to you about of Thomas and Vaflard, show patterns of emotional interaction. First, we need to remember that the times when a police commissioner came to record a complaint surely represented interactions that went beyond the norm, either because they were particularly violent, insulting, or disruptive. While we can imagine ribbing and teasing being part of the workplace, the kind of shouting, cursing, and fighting that emerges in complaints goes well beyond that. Second, this case and others demonstrate that the point most often exploited by emotional transaction was that of hierarchy. While journeymen sometimes fought one another, these kinds of disputes only brought official attention when they spun out of control. Commissioners recorded complaints when subordinates insulted superiors, that is, when those on the bottom refused to acknowledge and acquiesce to the hierarchy that structured and governed the workshop. In rejecting the validity of the hierarchy that was supposed to enforce authority, journeymen and workers also questioned the honor of masters and guild officers, challenging one of the guild's most cherished ideals. A close examination of this episode reveals strong emotional language. The demeanor of these two men in entering the room where jurés were holding their ceremony suggest the men's state of mind. Witness Jean Curlu, master pastry maker, explained that, quote, they came into the office where we were making a big scene, saying whatever they wished to say. Another witness, Michel Leclerc, said that, quote, they seemed to be in a fury as they came into the meeting room. They were loud and had brought a member of the municipal guard. No one could induce any of them to leave. They greeted one of the jurés as, quote, a damn young whippersnapper, a futu jeune barbe, and a rascal, a coquin. And coquin is particularly sharp because it's what you call your kids when they misbehave. So he's not only calling him a rascal, he's treating him like a child. As they told him, they did not have anything to explain to him. Nicolas Chartier noted that the two men, quote, caused a big furor and that their entrance, quote, provoked strong emotions in the room. Jacques Cottreau testified that, quote, they entered the room showing arrogance and insolence and began to insult all sitting at the table. One of the other masters asked them, quote, what right do you have to act like this? Which provoked a further string of insults and threats. Several witnesses remarked that, quote, they wanted to enrage the jury and former officers, and that they wanted to insult both the jury and the community. The attack on the guild and its rules, hierarchy, and demands for subservience were more insulting, given that Thomas and Vaflard interrupted and mocked one of the most important events of the artisanal calendar, the reception of new masters. The language employed by Thomas and Vaflard clearly addressed clashes over status, hierarchy, and authority. When Thomas refused to answer the query, what right do you have to act like this? He was defying both the person posing the question and the guild system that claimed the right to control members' conduct. Rather than suppress what they wanted in favor of performing the decorous conduct demanded at this guild function, they openly asserted themselves. Another emotional expression found in the records of disputes was laughter. While not as overtly hostile and critical as curses and insults, laughter was considered to be an equally insulting action. One of the offenses that more than half of the witnesses to this incident noted in their accounts was the, quote, derisive laughter, le fou rire, that accompanied their insults against the jury. Jean Lenard quoted the men as saying upon their arrival, quote, Monsieur Buggers, we are going to laugh well. Jacques Cottreau explained as well that when the two men were entering the building, they, quote, were apparently laughing that together they would start a row. Jacques de la Pierre declared that, quote, they entered laughing with great vivacity, saying they would speak against the present assembly. I think there are two primary ways to understand the significance of laughter in this context. First, laughter had an edge of political and social criticism to it. It was one of the few weapons subordinates could use against their superiors in a sharply hierarchical social context. Laughter traditionally served as, quote, a powerful tool of social protest, of the idiomatic world turned upside down, a funny and subversive way to play with established rules and hierarchies. This use of laughter often found its way into the political realm, where powerless citizens could use it to question official actions. Journeyman's use of mocking and laughter to tease and criticize resembles this political use of laughter to attack an authority figure that is impervious to other kinds of actions. Without any real power, laughter is left to register disapproval and dissent. Second, it provided another way to express the internal state of the individuals involved. The curses and insults lobbed during these arguments expressed anger, difference of opinion, and resentment. They were one way to vent feelings about the state of affairs in the shop. Thomas and Vaflard were insulted by their treatment in the guild office, a perception that must have existed for some time, given that they reportedly arrived there ready to quarrel. Laughter provided a potentially more effective way to express the complex emotional relationship between workers and masters than even the curses that peppered arguments. Journeymen could show their anger through words, but this anger reinforced the hierarchical relationship of the shop. Cursing took the place of concrete action for those not empowered to act, but laughter showed disdain, and in doing so, questioned the master's power over his workers. This subversive understanding of laughter and its potency as a weapon of the weak against the strong had prevailed in France for several centuries, finding one of its most extensive expressions in the writings of François Rabelais. Michael Bakhtin's masterful reading of laughter in Rabelais argued that the meaning of laughter as a universal phenomenon and one of the essential forms of the truth was connected to its being forbidden in the official sphere of life and ideology, but with exceptional privileges of license and lawlessness outside these spheres. With the granting of this space, laughter, quote, enjoyed privileges. It liberated to a certain extent from censorship, oppression, and from the stake. It was for the subordinate members of society that laughter was the most potent weapon, given the dearth of ways they could protest. Bakhtin explains that, quote, not only does laughter make no exceptions for the upper stratum, but indeed it is usually directed toward it. Laughing workers and journeymen ridiculing their masters and guild officials formed part of this tradition of using jokes, pranks, and teasing to act against those in power. Thomas and Vaflard could show their disdain for the master's reception and judging of the masterwork, And although their actions produced no change in the structure of the system, they were able to express their frustration and resentment. Now, like emotions, the meaning of laughter, too, changed in the 18th century, in part due to the influence of two different institutions. Again, going back to the culture of the 17th century royal court, in implementing and enforcing a strict code of etiquette, the appropriate application of laughter was constrained. Overall, emotional expression was tightly managed, and in this regard, laughter could be employed only in certain instances. At the court, laughter is, quote, laughter is almost wholly reduced to its negative, destructive dimensions as irony and satire. The use of laughter expanded dramatically in the 18th century, becoming a way to show a much larger range of emotional responses. Laughter could be used not only by those dispensing behavioral norms, as at court, but by individuals to make a variety of points. In the genealogy of laughter, so to speak, the 18th century was one where, quote, conflict over cultural, social, and political identities played out on the terrain of laughter. Just as ideas and discussion escaped the confines of royal oversight with the development of salons, laughter too escaped those confines and became another way to express an opinion or feeling about important issues. Those without status and authority could use laughter in this situation to push back against or comment on dominant social norms. Laughter migrated from a tool of the court to ridicule transgressors of court etiquette, to a way to express oneself against social superiors. In some ways, this use and understanding of laughter marks a return to Rabelaisian ambivalent laughter as a way to turn the world upside down. This exploration of the emotional language of conflict in the guilds sheds light on issues that have not yet been fully examined. Without question, the meaning of conflict in terms of how guilds functioned, their identities, internal workings, and institutional structure have been fruitfully considered by quite a few scholars. However, I argue that thinking about the emotions expressed in these disputes reveals not only other facets of guild functioning and identity, but also shows the ways individuals related to and acted within the guild system. Joining a consideration of emotions to a more expansive view of artisanal culture as expressed in statutes, writings, rituals, and the like provides a way to see both the individual's understanding of and action as part of an artisanal identity, as well as the culture of the guilds writ large, one more critical than formal guild ideology suggests. Thank you.
Well, I've got like deep questions.
Okay, good. 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 Well, good. I'm glad you.
Just as you were one, because I've probably heard other people are wondering about to what degree does alcohol come into play? Is that, you know, how much of this is
Yeah. That's a good question. Sometimes my sense of it is that, given what we know about consumption of alcohol in this century, probably everybody was drinking. Nobody is abstaining from alcohol pretty much always in everyday life, is my sense of things. So sometimes in these complaints, witnesses will say so-and-so was drinking or so-and-so seemed drunk. So my sense of it is that if witnesses made that comment, it means that they were absolutely blindingly drunk, because I think most people were probably in some state of inebriation. What's striking about this case that I talked about here is that nobody says that they're drunk. They say they're crazy, they say they came showing, you know, ready to fight, but nobody says they're drunk. Does that mean this is a party that they're kind of crashing, so is everybody drunk and they don't really stand out? Are they sober? It's unclear. It's a good question, and it's ambivalent. If we just looked at some cases, witnesses say that the workers are drunk, and sometimes they don't. I would say if you just want to look at that criteria, you're probably looking at about a quarter of the cases I've looked at where there's a comment that so and so was drunk, or you know, so.
Does that exonerate people
Yeah. Say, well, we know that John was drinking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he wasn't necessarily in control of emotions.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so one sort of question about this that I think is not necessarily something that can be answered is that we don't actually know what happens to any of these people. I've done a lot of work in the police records for my book and then for this project, and there are virtually no cases that move beyond a police complaint to some kind of court process where there'd be punishment, where you might hear something like, well, we're not going to punish so-and-so because they were drunk or whatever. As far as we know, as far as the records tell us, essentially there's no reckoning as a result of these complaints. Speculate that going to court is an expensive proposition, and so it's good enough to just kind of get this rough justice of the commissioner comes, he takes witness statements, he kind of makes a statement at the end, like, stop beating your wife, or stop yelling at your master, or, pay your journeyman, or whatever, and that's basically it. And in those kinds of very informal reckonings, there's really, I haven't seen any commissioners say, well, just let this guy go home and sleep it off, because clearly, he's impaired. So.
Other questions?
No. I was curious, what percentage of society belongs to the somewhat?
Yeah, it's a pretty small percentage, I would say. First of all, it depends on what city you're in. The bigger cities did have guilds. Villages and smaller cities would not have guilds, and so that the kind of skilled work that we're talking about here is open to anyone who puts out a shingle. So in Paris, you're looking at, Paris is going to be the stronghold of guild structure. You're looking at probably about 12%. So this is a minority. These are the elite of the working classes, because most people work, but it's an incredible privilege to be part of the guild or to be affiliated with the guild. And as a result, people who are part of the guilds, they earn a lot more money than most workers. They have a lot more stability. They have, a better status in their community because they have this sort of imprimatur of the guilds. Yeah. They do. They do. And what happens is that the king will periodically come to the guilds and say, I am going to sell 50 masterships to raise money for the crown. And so either I can sell those masterships to people who come and ask for them, or I can sell them to you. And almost invariably, the guild would buy those masterships because, of course, they don't want to dilute the value of the masterships that they have. So it is not called a tax, but that's what it is. And so, yes, the crown gets a lot of revenue out of the guilds.
Okay, another question. What is the relation of the guilds to something like some organization like the Masons or the Church?
The Masons, at this point in France, that's essentially the domain of elites. And so there's really not too much overlap between people who are in the guilds and people who are Masons. The church, each guild, and this is something I cut out of my paper, actually, each guild has a religious organization attached to it called a confraternity that members of the guild would join. And the confraternity would pay for funerals for deceased members. They would give money to widows and orphans. And they would have special masses to celebrate different holy days throughout the year. And each guild had a patron saint. And so one of the biggest holy days of the year for each guild is the time when they say the Mass for their saint's day.
So even though it might be in Paris 12%, the influence
is yes. And part of it is that if you, there's all these really interesting pamphlets where guilds and guild masters at certain moments of crisis, when the king and the royal government seem like they might want to abolish the guilds or change the guilds, they'll write these defenses of themselves where they say, if you abolish the guild, all hell is going to break loose. We are all that, you know, they will essentially say, we are all that stand between, you know, our situation today and utter chaos. And so one of the things that I think the guild does through its rhetoric and through its influence in society is that it really creates this sense that workers are, you know, this far away from just tearing the place down, and that it is their goal to keep workers in line, both within the guilds and also by sort of setting a good example and limiting the economic marketplace for those workers that are not outside the guilds. So they're very influential, and one of the signs of their influence is, for example, when there are processions for different big events, like when if the queen and king have a child, there'll be a big royal procession, and some of the guilds will participate in that. There's a guild that has the right to meet the royal child before anyone else. So the guilds do have sort of social advantages and social benefits that make them seem really important, symbolically, to a wider group than just those members of the guilds. This is just
I don't know if anybody in here studies the guilds. Probably not, because it's sort of a small, we're like a small, this is a huge point of controversy, and there's sort of, there are those historians who think the guilds remain fairly open. Now the guilds, guilds are abolished during the French Revolution in 1791, and as part of a broad economic liberalization. So there are those historians who say that guilds remained somewhat open throughout the century, and I tend to think, from my research, that the guilds become very closed. Why do they become very closed? I think there's a couple reasons. One is that France has sort of a population boom at the end of the 17th, the beginning of the 18th century. The guilds don't want to dilute the value of their masterships, and so they try to, press back against all these, numerous aspirants by locking the ability to get masterships to sort of their core people. The other thing is, I think that, as I mentioned a little bit, the economy is changing pretty dramatically. This whole consumer revolution that happens in late 17th and 18th century Europe. And so there's a lot more pressure on guilds in terms of how much they produce, how they produce it, prices. And I think that rather than the guilds sort of looking at this growing market as an opportunity, they just kind of get scared and they kind of shut the place down. Because I don't think that they can see a way to liberalize, to use a loaded word, to open up without losing the benefits that they have. So I would say it's partly demographic, and it's partly just this really ingrained culture of the guild, that the guild is about being closed, knowing everyone who's in the group, controlling everyone who's in the group, and opening up access is going to endanger both the economic value and sort of the cultural value of what a mastership is.
Is click a French word?
C
C-L-I-Q-U-E. It is, yes.
Is that part of what this group? My aunt, she told me one time, she was Polish, she said, well, we're part of our clique. And it was a positive term. This is how we make things work so very well. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a negative thing, but if you're in it, if you're not, you're not part of it.
Right. Well, certainly, the guilds don't use the word clique itself, but certainly this idea of insiders and outsiders is at the very core of what the guild is about. And a number of historians of guilds are really look at this sort of social and cultural function of the guild as being almost more important than the economic function of the guild. So what's important about the guild is keeping people out that you don't want, and welcoming people in that you do want, and rewarding them, and helping them prosper. And one of the ways that you help members of the guild prosper is by keeping outsiders away, because you're not sure about them, you don't know if they're gonna conform to all your rules. The more masters you have, the less exclusive your privileges are. So they don't actually use that word, but certainly the idea of insider and outsider is absolutely central to what the guilds are about.
Let me follow up on that in terms of what you were saying before. If I'm the king and I have to say I'm going to award 15 new masterships, well, if I'm simply looking around the room and saying who's going to ante up some money to get a mastership, that doesn't mean that individual necessarily is a watchmaker.
That's right. No, that's right.
I mean, I've always understood guilds the way that we understand construction building trades in the United States, which is the idea that you are limiting entrants to be able to restrict your main labor market on one side and to maintain high quality.
Absolutely.
So to what degree? I mean, the idea that a king would say, I'm simply going to hand these babies out to whoever I want to, by its very nature, that strikes at the labor market, which I can understand.
Right. Yes. Yes. Right. Absolutely. I mean, I see it as sort of a piece of kabuki theater. Everybody knows the king is not going to sell those things on the open market. And they know that the guilds are going to buy them because they have so much to lose if the king just sells them on the open market. Now, one of the sections I took out of here, there's this very serious proposal in 1776 to get rid of the guilds because there's this particular minister, a finance minister, who wants to liberalize the grain market, liberalize the labor market, kind of looking at England as a model for how to organize the economy in a more open fashion. And, the guilds, all of the guilds, just kind of go bananas, and they just start writing and writing and writing to the king. And one of the points they make is, in France, we have a reputation for creating, high-quality goods because we have this guild structure. Our luxury market is the most sought after in the world. If you open up work to anyone, there will be no quality control, and the value of our exports will plummet, as well as the value of the domestic market, because no one will know if what they buy is good or not, if it's true or not. So absolutely, this is on the minds of everyone involved in this debate, the issue of quality. Yeah. Thanks. that's a great question. One response I would have to that is that
Guilds are very old. Guilds go back to the, 13th and 14th century. And so, they have a long history and tradition of functioning in a certain way, which, surprisingly remains fairly stable until the 18th century. And so I think for guildmasters, this idea of hanging on to the way they've always done things and hanging on to their values, it's not only is it just ingrained in them through the weight of history and tradition, it also, they can't see another path to doing the same thing. So if you're talking about traders, merchants, big level merchants, this kind of activity, the way it evolves, this kind of activity is harder to restrain. It doesn't have the same kind of institutional framework going back the way the guilds do. And so I think traders are more open to change. And the other thing is, if you look at, because I do look a little bit at merchants in the other research, they have a lot more contact with people in the German states or in Spain or in England. And so they are just subject to the kind of, relentless competition, push to innovate, push to see what the next new thing is in a way that guild masters, through their persistence in holding back legal change and through their monopoly of the market, just are not subject to.
Well, I mean, just because you just posed my next question there is, what about innovation?
Well, there's a book that came out just a few years ago on this question because, of course, Marx talks about guilds as being sort of, the dead end of production innovation. And I think that assumption was accepted until a couple years ago when a couple of historians have really looked into how the guilds worked internally and found that they, in fact, that even though they're closed systems, they are still engaged in innovation. And that if you look at, increase in exports, increase in the domestic market of goods, that in fact the guilds are able to compete on an international basis, that they're able to keep a big share of the domestic market, even as imports are becoming, are coming into France more and more. And so they are able to, internally improve and innovate. And so this research has kind of put the lie to this idea that the only way to innovate is to have complete free and open competition, that if you have a closed group that has an interest in innovation, they will do it. You don't need to have that constant, the market constantly nipping at your heels to make you do it. Hopefully that's enough, because I don't have anything else to say on that. So you mean artisanship, like this idea of craftsmanship and quality? Certainly in their rhetoric, they talk about this all the time. I mean, so that if the question posed is, why do we need the guilds? We need the guilds because without the guilds, craftsmanship will be destroyed. So the guilds, one of the things that guilds do, and maybe this also connects to your question, they have inspectors go around with some frequency to shops to make sure that, they're only using licensed workers, they're not hiring day laborers, that they're using the right kinds of tools, materials, and techniques. And so if you read guild statutes, they really lay out, you're supposed to use these kinds of tools, you're supposed to use these kinds of techniques, you're supposed to have this kind of, production process. And that does change. I mean, the guilds publish statutes with some regularity dealing with that. So there, you can see the innovation happening through that process. But they also take it really seriously to go into shops and make sure they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. What happens as the guilds decline and then they're abolished in the late 18th century, the French, I mean, it's interesting, the French enterprises largely hang on to a lot of the core process of production that they take from the artisanal period. So, you know, there's this great book, you know, which is now 30 years old, but William Sewell's Work and Revolution in France, where he really lays this out, the way that artisanal process and artisanal values hang on past the destruction of the guilds themselves. Why? I would say it's because it works, because France is able to continue to, you know, create products that are high quality, that are desired on the foreign market, and there's no reason to get rid of this craftsmanship. So I would say craftsmanship is really central to a French economic sensibility. Yes. Yes, that's
right.
Can you
tell us how that gap was filled between the institutional decline
of guilds and the rise of what was the is there some kind of state so the guilds are abolished during the French Revolution, and the revolutionary government is very serious about economic growth and economic processes, and they create, you know, it's not a ministry, it's a, I think they call it a Bureau of Economic Quality, or it's called something like that. So the state steps in and enforces this. So I would say that, you know, so the reason that the government abolishes the guilds is not because they want production to, you know, range all over the map, it's not because they want to create a low end of the market and compete on price with this gaudy little knickknacks. It's because they want the state to come in and regulate economically. And the guilds don't fit into the sort of political rhetoric of the revolution, which is, you know, of citizenship, of individual relationships, and you don't want groups or organizations mediating between individuals and society, or individuals and the state. So you have to get rid of the guilds for that political, rhetorical reason, but they have a lot of good qualities that the state tries to hang on to. So, yeah.
Great. Well, let me ask one last thing, because I think that by talking about regulation, you started with the guild police, okay? So, and so the police, you know, in that policing function, are the police actually working for the guild, are they working for the government finance? Through guild taxes.
Right, yeah.
And, I mean, in effect, are there specific laws that I am breaking? Am I breaking guild law, or am I breaking state law?
Right. The case that I talked about, that is a City of Paris police commissioner. So those people, that complaint revolves around their disorderly behavior. And so they are breaking sort of civil code by acting like that. There are also guild police that go around and enforce guild statute and guild regulation. And some of those people are actual employees of the guild, and some of them are actually employees of the state. So there's definitely, you know, if this is sort of, this is what I'm sort of taking out of your question, there's a complete, you know, mixing together of the, policing power and function of the government and the policing power and function of the guilds. And so the guilds and the police are working in tandem, sometimes literally in tandem, where guild officers and police officers are coming to a situation at the same time. And sometimes just the guild, and sometimes just the police.
Well, there's a question on regulation. What's happened many times is the government quotes itself. I mean, it automatically takes what is already a private set of recommendations or regulations.
Yes.
The most modern version of that is the occupational safety and health
yep.
act. There were a number of things that were automatically transferred into being new standard, but they were internal union, I mean internal company standards.
Right. Right. Made, yeah. Right.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. So if you broke a guild statute, you could potentially be faced with a City of Paris police commissioner who would reprimand you in the name of the city government, not necessarily just in the name of the guild. So,
what
yes.
about putting you in jail?
Nobody's put in jail for fighting with their master, as far as I can as far as I can tell. As far as I can tell, nobody's put in jail for that. You know, if it goes to an actual, you know, beating or, you know, theft or something, yeah, yeah, that's right, yeah, yeah.
Instead, they ship you to America, and you were here instead.
That's right, that's right.